Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and welcome to episode number 48 as we continue counting down our favorite movies of all time. We are up to number 53, which for me would have been Almost Famous, but it has been replaced by John's favorite, new favorite movie of all time, The Last Days of Disco. While we will be talking about John's number 53, which is Parasite, which also happened to be my number 54, so they came in just next to each other. But yeah, so that one is a very interesting conversation because we're both just going to talk incredibly positively about it, especially since we almost had it in identical spots. Last Days of Disco will be a little bit different because Whit Stillman is American AF and John does not necessarily like that. So, John, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed watching Parasite again because I know that Last Days of Disco is pretty much pulling teeth for you, even though you are just flat out wrong.
You know, when it comes to Last Days of Disco, once again, just like I did with Barcelona, I was like, do I need to watch this movie again to like figure out how I feel about it? And I just came to the conclusion, if I'm still wondering how I feel about a Whit Stillman movie after the first watch, probably means I don't like Whit Stillman movies.
Mm. You'll get there. You just got to get a little bit more mature. That's the problem.
Oh, of course.
But yeah, after watching Parasite again, and obviously that'll be the second movie we talk about since The Last Days of Disco is about as popular as I am. Parasite, man, that is just a timeless movie already, and you just know it's going to be a timeless classic. And I'm very excited to talk about why I chose Rules of the Game last week, now that I'm remembering why I chose Rules of the Game last week, because boy are these movies very, very similar. And despite being 80 years apart in age, they prove that no matter where you live in the world and no matter what, everybody's still worried about the same things. No matter where you live in the world, no matter what era, it doesn't matter. You're all still worried about the same shit. So, but of course, we're going to be starting with The Last Days of Disco, which is in here as my replacement for Almost Famous. And I got to say, probably this movie just kicked out another movie from this original list of top 100. So as we've been going through this, I've been re-updating my top 100 as we go, just to kind of see like, where do I actually feel that a certain movie belongs at this point? And, I've moved some stuff around, and about now my bottom five would all be kicked off officially. I think that this one officially makes it six. I love The Last Days of Disco. I think that Whit Stillman, what he does so well in all of his movies, in this, what is it, the Bourgeois trilogy, which of course just makes John want to like smash his skull against the laptop or whatever he's got. But what he does so well is he really captures what it is being young in America and then what people outside of America really think about Americans, which, and he captures this pompousness so well. He captures the struggles so well. I love the way he's able to capture all of the relationships, everything that's happening with these bars and, oh, we got kicked out of this one, so now it's time to go to the next one. And it's time to just keep moving on. And all of these conversations that seems so unbelievably important to you in the moment. And then as you get older, you almost make fun of yourself for having these conversations. Kate Beckinsale is just like, she's like up here when she's in a Whit Stillman movie. I don't know if you've ever seen Love and Friendship. It's my least favorite of his movies by far. It's not even close, but she's just so good at delivering his dialogue where you're like, she is just a bad person. Like, she really is a bad person in every one of these. Chloe Sevigny, who I always pronounce her name wrong, I love her. But Chris Eigenman, this is his best one out of the trilogy. And everybody now knows that I love Chris Eigenman. I think he's absolutely ridiculous. But what I love about this movie, and what I think ultimately does make it better than Barcelona, and what I think makes it such a great movie, and why I chose it against Almost Famous, is the music in this movie is essentially its own character. The music in this movie is so important to what's going on. Because at the end of the day, this movie is about a bunch of spoiled assholes, a bunch of spoiled yuppies. What's wrong with being a young upward mobility, whatever the phrase is that Eigenman says. But they're all so spoiled. And they're all just having conversations. That's all it is. Just conversation after conversation. But the music makes it feel like something epic is actually happening. And I think that that is so indicative of what it's really like to like go out on a night in a city in your youth. It feels like something epic is happening every time you do it. And in reality, you're just talking about nonsense that you're all going to forget about 5 years down the line. But I love what he's able to capture with this movie. And now I'll just let John start giving me talking points that I can defend, much like he tried to do last week with The Last Jedi before he fell on his face and fell, you know, all that fun stuff.
It's not what how I remember it. But when it comes to Whit Stillman, I do appreciate how he navigates conversation, because he does have this knack for it where he's able to get these deep conversations in this kind of like nonchalant tone. But that's kind of where I get disengaged with Whit Stillman, because all of his characters say absolutely everything so matter-of-factly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such little emotional range in the movie that it just kind of feels a bit dry for me. And I appreciate it. It's not like I'm out there giving this movie like a one-star review. I do think I ended up giving it 2 stars, I think.
Yeah, you did.
I just got to this point where, like I said, I was sitting there after watching this, like, do I hate this movie or do I love this movie? And I just had to keep it in that middle ground and say, if I can't discern that, then mm-hmm. it has to just like fall in this middle ground where it's like there are aspects of it that I really appreciate, but there are aspects of it that just drive me insane.
Yeah, that was Tom Jones for me, the 1963 Best Picture winner. I think it was 63. Just pure nonsense. That movie is just pure nonsense. But I couldn't tell if it was brilliant or idiotic. The one thing, though, and I texted you about this, is I do think that Stillman's movies are very much made for Americans mm-hmm. who have, like, also, though, like, Americans who also do have an understanding of the world outside of America, but mm-hmm. a very American understanding of the world outside of America. And I think that he is so good at that, because what Stillman does in all of his movies is he lets you know that, like, yeah, we're not that smart. Americans, they're not cultured necessarily. But he also lets you know that they don't really care. And he expresses mm-hmm. that so often in his movies, where it's not important to them that all these other things are happening. They'll talk about all the bigger things, and they'll talk about what's important about it and all that. But at the end of the day, they're more worried about having a good time in their one little it's a very, you know, we've heard it nonstop since the pandemic started. It's a very selfish culture. It's a very mm-hmm. individualistic culture. And he is so good at capturing that, because even Kate Beckinsale plays Alice in this movie. Is it Alice and Charlotte or whoever it is? But Alice and Charlotte, they are just so mean to each other, or at least Alice is very mm-hmm. mean to Charlotte, yes. if that's who it is. They're so mean to each other. They're like, they don't even get along that well. And yet they're going out together every friggin' night so they can go try to find guys, and they're dancing together and whatever it is. But at the end of the day, like, they don't even know if they're good enough of friends to go in and live together, you know? And I just think, like, he expresses so much just with the little decisions that he makes with these characters and with their relationships. And then you bring in somebody like Dez, who's just a total piece of shit, but he's a piece of shit that's so entertaining to watch completely make an ass out of himself. And when he's saying these things that might seem very dated, such as a guy who is lying about being gay to be able to sleep with women, it is still something, though, that in the, what is it, the 80s in New York City, for a guy at a club like that, was probably happening. And it wasn't that he was mm-hmm. saying he was gay to sleep with women. He's saying he was gay to break up with women so he wouldn't hurt their feelings. That's what yep. he was doing. Like, Whit Stillman doesn't say that what Dez is saying is right or wrong. He's just saying this is something that somebody would say. This is something, like, this is a real person.
And that's the big thing that Whit Stillman does do, is he kind of takes out any emotional and, like, cultural bias out of the film completely. Because mm-hmm. I even wrote, one of my notes is, I can't figure out if Stillman is being hypercritical of these people or condoning their behavior. And it's because he's not. He's not doing either of them. He is just presenting them. Mm-hmm. And that is what he does well. Is like, when you watch a Stillman movie, yes, we don't have this range of emotion or anything, but what we do get is we actually just get a clear picture of people interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and doing so in a way that, like, to me just feels so realistic. I mean, I love, like, all these little conversations about, like, Lady and the Tramp, about, mm-hmm. you know, the dogs and everything like that, how Bambi really sparked the environmental, like, you know, movement and all that. How now he's talking about, oh, the first time you ever slept with somebody, you got G and H. And she's like, what do you mean H? Like, all of these little things they're said in such matter-of-fact ways, which you say to yourself, okay, well, is that how people really talk? Well, sometimes. I mean, people probably talk more closely to how Whit Stillman's characters talk than most other characters in movies. Because dialogue is so heavily stylized for movies. I was watching Primal Fear last night, the Ed Norton, Richard Gere movie. And there's a part in it where he just like, it's a very good movie, but there's a part in it where he just looks at me and he's like, come on, you're not listening to me. Say what you mean to say. And I'm like, that is a writer writing that because a producer told him to write that. Whit Stillman doesn't have anything like that in any of his movies. His characters are just reacting. And I love the part where the one character says like, what, women like, women prefer men bad, prefer women weak, indecisive, and unemployed or something like that. Or women prefer men weak, indecisive, and unemployed. And the guy just responds like, women prefer weak, indecisive, and unemployed. Like, it's just like, these are such natural reactions to the things you'd be hearing. And it seems like all of these characters, like, it's Charlotte, who is Kate Beckinsale, but Charlotte is so much just the egotistical bitch the entire movie. Charlotte is, or Alice is so much like the trying to find her way and not really being confident in herself person. Jimmy Steinway, just totally a fraud in this area that he's not, he doesn't belong yet, and he's trying everything he kind of belong. Dez, who is just never going to grow up and is just going to keep sleeping with everybody, and he's not an addict, he's a habitual user. That's one of my favorite lines of all time. But you know, all of those things from them, they're all very much are who they are. And it's so difficult, but there's really not much of a story going on. It's a hangout movie, but it's a hangout movie. The best hangout movies to me, like this, Everybody Wants Some, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it doesn't need a really big, powerful story. It just needs to make you feel something. And the characters need to stay true to who they are, no matter what comes to them. And in this movie, every single one of these characters just stays exactly true to who they are.
And I think that's part of what makes Whit Stillman so divisive in general, is the fact that his characters are just so real and so natural that it's jarring for people when they watch his films, because you go into a film and you're expecting these over the top characters. You're expecting people to be these caricatures of real people. But when you go and you're watching a Whit Stillman movie, you're seeing people. It's like Whit Stillman, the dialogue in this movie feels like it's not even written. Like you said, it's not, it's not someone being like, okay, this has to be written this way. It's just like Whit Stillman sat there, listened to a conversation, and transcribed it.
And I think too, like, he is able to make something profound that isn't profound. And he does that over and over again in all of his movies. So many of the conversations that take place in this movie really are meaningless, but for the characters, this is how they're discovering aging. Like, this is how they're growing up. This is, and these are the types of nonsense conversations that you do have with your friends when you just go out and you're drinking, or you run into strangers and you meet them and you have your one night where you're like, oh, this is like my best friend in the world. And then the next day you don't even talk to him again. You know what I mean? Like, I'll never forget, there was one time when I was in LA, and it was like, oh, you meet people at a bar, let's go to this bar that we happen to own, and we'll just go in, because LA has like their whatever, and you go in and like you have this great thing. Don't know any of their names, don't know who they were, none of that, but it's still something that you did that was fun, that you remember, because when you're young you do that. And now I look back at them, I'm like, I would never do that again. Like, what the hell was I thinking? But Stillman is able to capture that like hopefulness of youth with also the despair of the fact that you're not very youthful, and that you're getting older, and that you're having to have responsibilities, and you don't really know how to handle those responsibilities. He's able to nail all of it right down the line, and make these relationships, make the dynamics always watchable. I always love, and I forget what her name is. I forget what his name is too, to be frank, but I know his actor's name. But Matt Ross and the girl who's the third roommate, who they really don't know. I don't know if that's Nina or Holly or whatever her name is. I think it's Holly.
Holly
and Matt Ross. I love that relationship, because here it is, like, Matt Ross, they can't stand. Holly doesn't really even belong in their group. And here they are hooking up. And now they're, you know, everybody's just got to kind of deal with that happening and can't believe it's happening, but it is happening. And like, that is such a real thing that would happen, where it is so on the periphery of what is important in this movie, but that's because we're seeing it from the eyes of Alice and Charlotte, who don't care that they're doing that, even though they don't really like either of them. It's still not important to them. And so we're getting it kind of from their point of view, where it's like, how did this start happening? Like, where, like, when was this established?
And then immediately afterwards, it's like, when was this unestablished?
Yeah.
Because it's just like one scene they're together and the next scene they're not together. And you're like, oh, okay. And in any other movie, we probably would see the breakup scene or something going there. But it's just, it's not what Whit Stillman's going for in this movie. Because what we're getting is the dichotomy between Charlotte and Alice's characters and the fact that, like, they both work together in this publishing house. And then they spend their evenings together in discos. And it's just that juxtaposition of the two lifestyles that we're seeing that really gives this film a lot of its heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm trying to think of, like, when it comes to those juxtapositions, like, they're both so career-oriented. But then I also like how at the end, when she's walking away with Chris Eigenman and they're having their heart-to-heart about, I don't think I could ever fail. The reason I wouldn't fail is because of this and that and the other. And the way that they, like, both of their arrogance is coming out, but it's still in that way of, like, yeah, this is stuff that, like, 22, 23, 24-year-olds say. Like, there's no way they could possibly fail. Like, they're going to be – she's going to be successful in the TV industry because of this, even though she wasn't successful in the publishing industry because she didn't do all the things that she's saying she's now going to do. And then Chris Eigenman's just like, you know, we're a lot alike. Like, I love those types of things. And there's some, like, when you have those moments, the one thing that I will always say about Whit Stillman and why I think his movies resonate so much with me is you're never going to see a conversation like that in any other movie where both characters just agree with each other the way that two people with those personalities would. Normally, you know, it's the whole thing that dialogue should be like a sword fight, you know. That's not what Whit Stillman does. Whit Stillman just lets it kind of be it's like a ballet. He doesn't care. He doesn't want his characters fighting. There doesn't have to be conflict in everything that's happening. It's the conflict is you as an audience sitting there going, yeah, you're not going to be as successful as you think you are. But you never will see something like that conversation between Beckinsale and Eigenman in any other movie. And I think that's what makes his stand out so much for me.
Yeah. I mean, we keep circling around that same point where it's just like, because Whit Stillman isn't writing his stories the same way other people do, it's just so atypical. And for some people, that's just such a good thing. And for others, it's just such a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and what this one really does, though, and to just, you know, harp on this, the music in this movie and the way that it keeps driving these conversations, and, like, you know, they're having a conversation about, you know, what, Lady and the Tramp, and you have, like, this disco music just blasting in the background. Like, it just creates such a nostalgic emotion for something that I was never even a part of. And I never will be a part of, even though, as John pointed out, Korea now has a disco movement happening. Yeah, John, you'll have to get into that a little bit. But it's this whole thing of, like, the music just keeps on pushing this movie forward, keeps on pushing the relationships forward. Everything is that, like, more and more and more playing in the background while they're having a completely mundane conversation. That song is one of the most danceable songs ever. And they're having a completely mundane conversation. But that's a lot of times what's happening in these clubs. You're going to have this DJ who's going crazy with everything. And most people are going there and just sitting there. And, you know, he's just – that's a nice little – what, the opposites of that, of the music with what is being discussed. It's like, why did he want to set this during the disco era? Well, because – it's that whole speech at the end about how disco is a thing that, you know, it'll never go away. It was too big. We lived it. It can't just go away. Sure, it'll be, you know, go out of fashion. People might even make fun of it for a while. And the thing is, like, that's not about disco. That's just about, you know, your youth and all of that. And, like, those fun moments that, unfortunately, when you sit down and you talk to people who are, like, 55 years old, all they want to talk about is how great their 20s were and their 30s were and how their 20s and 30s were better than your 20s and 30s. Even though everybody's 20s and 30s are going to be the best to them and their generation's 20s and 30s are going to be better than everybody else's, that's what this movie is addressing, and by him setting it during the last days of disco, an era that is so profoundly made fun of. Like, you think about this movie was made in 1998. It's set in the early 80s. Already everybody knew disco was shit. Like, everybody already hated disco with a passion. And obviously we see them burning the records and everything like that. Yeah. But it was to the point where, like, even the biggest defenders of disco were no longer defending disco. And it was only 15 years later, whatever it was. It's like you're even saying that even if you grew up with the crappiest version of all this, it's still too big to die, because it's what your youth was. It's what your excitement was. And it's what your, you know, your 20s were, and your friends and all that. It's too, you'll never forget that, even if everybody else does down the line. And eventually somebody's going to come back. They're going to do this exact same thing and be like, wow, this is the best thing ever. Like that. It's just, it's very deep, and it's very moving for a movie that on the surface just feels very, very, you know, superficial.
Yeah, and it's one of those deeper, like, philosophical themes that Stillman's really pushing on you here, is that idea that it's okay to get older because everyone does it. And, like, mm-hmm. that's what this, like, death of disco at the end of the movie really signifies, is that, yes, disco's over, but you lived it. And mm-hmm. that's what matters. And eventually it's going to come back. And like you said, Korea has a ton of disco music coming out, and some of the most popular music in the world right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's totally true. And I will say, though, like, Kate Beckinsale's unfair because she doesn't age. Like, you know, I mean, Kate Beckinsale, I mean, how old was Kate Beckinsale in this movie? Because it's crazy that, like, when she was in Van Helsing or whatever, she looks younger than she does in this movie. But now this is just for my own. But I'm just like, I just
25 when this movie came out.
Okay, so she was 25. I'm curious, what was Chloe, who I can never say her name, even though she was in a movie that you watched this week. So she was 24. So 25, 24. Very much. I feel like that's another smart decision, because Stillman never really gives us their ages, mm-hmm. but to make them both, like, you can tell that they're both in their mid 20s. It's no longer as fun as it was when they first started doing it, but they're also not over yet. And they're still going through, like, I always love the railway apartment. Like, mm-hmm. that is something that, like, she's like, well, isn't this going to be an awkward living situation? I think we should buy it. Okay, great. And they buy it, because you would only do that when you're 24, 25 years old, and you're just so desperate to not live with your parents, or to not, you know, to just go and live on your own and experience it, that you're going to put yourself in a situation where you have to walk through the hallway to get to your bedroom because you can't walk through the rest of the apartment because you're walking through people's rooms. Like, it's just mm-hmm. all of those little things. It is very much of the yeah, it's very, very much of like that age, 24, 25. Yes. You can feel that they're starting to realize it's going away, but that it's not completely gone just yet.
Yeah, exactly. Is that it? When you're 24, 25, you're just in that mindset where, let's try it. Let's mm-hmm. just try it. See where it goes. You're past, like, the crazy, like you said, past the crazy times of, like, university and everything like that, and college. And now you're at this point where you're just like, okay, well, I guess this is the real world. I guess we just have to get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go for it. I moved to the middle of nowhere at that time mm-hmm. of my life. Like, you make crazy decisions yeah. when you're just, like, so willing. And it's really interesting that, like, it all culminates in this railway, in this rail car apartment, which is probably one of the worst living conditions you could ever have in an apartment mm-hmm. anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very funny that is what he decided on. But also, it lets you know that Whit Stillman lived this. Like, this is something Whit Stillman did and was stuck in the situation of, and always wanted to get out. And another one, I looked up how old Chris Eigenman was in this movie. He was 33. So, I'm sorry, he was 43. So, wow, he was 33. I can't do math. He was 33. But 33 is a very, like, that is that age of, like, still clinging to it, don't have any other prospects, still clinging to it, this is all I have. And he's, like, the most miserable one in the entire movie out of everybody. But he's also the one who's spilling all those great Whit Stillman lines that Chris Eigenman is just fantastic at delivering. I just think, like, with this movie, it's endlessly quotable. The music is incredibly fun. I think that it really captures youth, but not in a college era youth. It's a different style of youth that we don't necessarily always see. And these aren't people who are going to become famous or become anything else. These are just regular people who are hoping to become something, who are hoping to become successful in some way. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not trying to become successful, they're just trying to have a good time. And I feel like we don't really see movies about that. Where, like, even Josh's character coming in as an assistant district attorney and he's going to screw everybody at the club, they still do that with kid gloves a little bit. However, it still feels like it's done in the way that it would be done. Like, it's not it's not an actual B storyline. It's just something that gets discussed every now and then, but it's not a storyline that you're seeing, like, all these different clips and, oh, how's it going? Are you ever going to make this happen? It's told in such a unique way, and I think that's what makes it so powerful.
Yeah, and it's also the fact that, like you said earlier, Stillman does this fantastic job at focusing on relationships. And that's what drives these movies of his, is it's not, because they're essentially plotless.
Yeah.
I'll just say it. Stillman movies have no plot whatsoever. And everything that drives them is just relationships. And your, like, social structures and social norms and interacting with that in a relationship. And that's what is so interesting about this movie, because we have the idea of, like, Alice as this virgin who goes out and loses her virginity at the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. And then we have Charlotte and her almost jealousy of Alice and how she's trying to prevent guys from asking her out. Mm-hmm. And then we have the whole idea of, like, pairing up, which is mentioned throughout the film, and how it's not about pairing up, but as these characters are maturing and aging, even though this movie takes place over a very short period of time in the grand scheme of things, we see them moving towards this social norm of pairing up no matter what they do.
And I mean, if you've watched this in the worst order you could possibly watch the trilogy in, because you watched the second one first, the third one second, and then you haven't seen Metropolitan, which was the first of the trilogy. But all of those movies are about the same thing. It's about trying to find love, trying to find a relationship, but in a plotless way, in a way where, like, you know, none of our lives really follow a plot. You know, at the end of the day, we're all just, you know, kind of going around doing what we can do and trying to figure it out. And he that's what he's doing. Whether you're trying to figure it out in Barcelona, whether you're trying to figure it out in the disco scene of New York City, or whether you're just trying to figure it out in New York City in general, where everybody just hangs out and drinks and dresses up really, really nice. John, you'll have to sit down and watch Metropolitan so I can watch you give it 2 stars. That's really what we're missing out on here. But that, all of his movies, just, they're about the same thing and trying to capture that. And I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that's the way he does a pretty good job of capturing it. Sorry, he's kind of distracting.
I can't deny that he does a good job of capturing that essence. It's just a decision as to whether or not I like that.
Did you like
something that tends to be escapist for me?
Did you like that Taylor Nichols played his Barcelona character?
It was nice, and it was just like, okay, I get it, but do we have to?
It does. What makes me laugh, though, is he's in Metropolitan as a different character, and Chris Eigenman's in all three of them as different characters, but there's people from Metropolitan who are in this one. It's great. All great stuff. All right, John, I'll let you get out of here so you don't have to keep talking about this, and we can start talking about Parasite. But before we do that, your homework is to watch Metropolitan so I can really see what you're doing.
We'll
see. All right. What was the best movie you watched this week?
I watched 2 very high movies on my list this week, because I watched Zodiac and The Social Network this week. I just kind of got in a Fincher mood over the last couple of days, but we're going to talk about them eventually. I rewatched Booksmart again, and once again, that movie is absolutely incredible.
Great soundtrack. One of the funniest movies ever to come out. You're talking about a great soundtrack.
Incredible.
One of the best, like one of the absolute best.
But I've also talked about that movie before, so I have to give it to High Noon this week. Gary Cooper's performance in that movie is absolutely incredible. I love the fact that it's less focusing on, like, the Western themes and more focusing on the characters themselves in the movie. And just, like, that inner turmoil of Kane and the fact that he knows he has this duty to fulfill, despite the fact that everyone's telling him, don't bother. It's a fantastic film.
I will say, too, with High Noon, I really like High Noon. I think that High Noon is unfortunately one of those movies that a lot of people don't understand the context of that movie anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that it's very important to do a little bit of research before you watch that movie so you can really understand what the movie is expressing. The movie had no chance of winning the Oscar that year. It's the one – that's the year it lost to the Greatest Show on Earth. And it had no chance of winning because of how politically driven this movie was at a time where people did not want politically driven movies. And doing the research on that really it elevates this movie quite a bit from where people who are just watching in 2022 might be thinking of it for sure. But yeah, that's a good one. Vred Zinnemann's a good director, very underrated director. Did A Man for All Seasons, From Here to Eternity, and High Noon. Like very, very, very underrated. My best one was Gigi, which is normally considered one of the worst Best Picture winners of all time. John, I know you're a huge musical fan, so this probably wouldn't be your cup of tea, but I found this musical to be absolutely hilarious, and it was ridiculously entertaining. Like, ridiculously entertaining. The opening song about little girls, yeah, that's a little weird. But also, you can't go into a movie that was made in 1958 and immediately be like, oh, well, that song's about little girls and it's misogynistic, and therefore I will hate this entire movie now. It was made in 1958. It was a different time. It was just a different time. Just watch the movie. It is so entertaining. It's ridiculous. The songs are catchy, even though none of them are iconic. But they're catchy. The lyrics to the songs are very, very funny. Most of it is kind of duets of people just completely arguing with each other. And the one character in the movie says, it's a bore about 9,000 times. And that is definitely going into my vernacular now. So I will be saying it's a bore a lot. I really wish I would have had that movie before I watched Columbus, because I would have just sat here and just been like, it's a bore. And that would have been it. But you should check it out. I really do think – I think it's one of the most underrated Best Picture winners of all time, because – I had a rough stretch there, and I will say this. I watched Out of Africa this week. Oh, my God, was that movie horrible. Like horrible. I'd heard so many bad things about that. I know this is supposed to be a positive movie podcast. I had heard so many bad things about Out of Africa. It blew those expectations out of the freaking water. I was like, how bad can it be? It's Robert Redford. It's Meryl Streep. I like epics. I like The English Patient a lot. People make fun of me for that. I like The English Patient a lot. I like The Last Emperor. I like movies like that. I watched this movie. I paused it 2 hours in. I turned to my fiance. I said, what is this movie about? And she goes, well, it's following that woman as she does stuff. And I was like, yeah, exactly. This movie is trash. And it was just terrible, terrible movie experience. So I will say, coming on the heels of that, watching Gigi, knowing that it wasn't really well received, got to say, much better than it gets credit for. Very, very, very entertaining movie. So yeah, people should definitely check it out. All right, let's get into Parasite, a movie that we both have. I have it at 54. John has it at 53. So it's technically John's movie, even though I put it first or it's something. True. Go ahead, John.
Well, when it comes down to it, is Parasite kind of revolutionized the way that people view cinema and entertainment now, because Parasite comes out, it's a Korean movie, and Korean movies don't tend to do that well in the West before this. In fact, I don't know if I could really name more than a handful of Korean movies released before this movie came
out. And they're all him.
Yeah. They are all the same director.
Yep.
And but what Parasite did was Parasite broke this barrier that was put up where everyone kind of thought that only English language films could ever win a Best Picture. Parasite comes out. It has some of the greatest social commentary ever. And it opened the door to a lot of social commentary on wealth disparity in Korea. We saw it again this year with Squid Games. Like, and this is just part of our culture now, is understanding this wealth disparity in Korea is presented in such a fun way. This is perhaps one of the most fun movies to end with a lot of people being murdered out there.
I completely agree. And that's why I was saying that I think this movie is ultimately a timeless classic, even though we're only 2 years removed from it. So here's one of my things. So a lot of people will throw that around all the time. And and you see it. Like a movie like Moonlight, a lot of people were saying that.
Yeah.
I personally don't believe that Moonlight is going to stand the test of time as well as people think that that movie is going to stand the test of time. Because it was very much of this time. And I still think it's a great movie. But I think it's very much of the 20 teens and what we're going through and representation and giving voice to a gay black man. That this was very much of this era. I think that when you start to look at what's a movie that's timeless, I'm also looking at it as it doesn't matter. Like you start looking at movies every time. The Passion of Joan of Arc from 1920, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's a silent movie. That's a timeless movie. The Rules of the Game, despite the fact that neither one of us loved the beginning of it, it has that one scene that makes absolutely no sense. That is a timeless movie. The Graduate is a movie that's timeless because no matter what time you graduate from college, you could go through the exact same thing Dustin Hoffman went through in that movie. And you know what? You could pretty much do it anywhere around the country or around the world. Maybe not so much in the East, but you could definitely do it in Europe, America. It doesn't matter. Like there's so much going on there. The beauty of this movie, it is a 2019 movie. Sorry, I just had like a, I don't even know. Movie coming out in 2019. Not Hollywood. It's Korean. A country that we don't really watch movies from here in Canada or in the United States. And yet it said everything better than what people, than what directors had been saying, trying to say in Hollywood for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Because while it's a very on the nose movie, there are so many amazing choices made in this movie that just continue to elevate it in a way where it proves its point more and more and more. And it doesn't have to have, and I always go back to the weakest version of it, but F them. It doesn't have a equal rights. You want anything else before we leave? Equal rights and whatever. And it's like, no, it doesn't have to say it. It just does it. And this movie is such a perfect example of show don't tell. Mm-hmm. And watching them constantly build their way up and get the family involved and everything that is happening in this movie, all for it to end with this ridiculous, over-the-top murder that takes place. It is just so powerful. And the smell, you can see he has a smell. Mm-hmm. He has a smell. It's pride. It's respect as he screams numerous times in this movie. And it is this... this, even when you're abused by somebody and you're living in their basement, the desire to still give them their respect and turn the lights on for them. We see that so much in America and all of that. And yet there has not been a single movie to ever come out in the United States that comes anywhere close to hitting what Parasite hits in this movie. And I think that's why it's been such a phenomenon.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it comes down to the way that it's set up. The movie's set up in a way where it doesn't have to be like, oh, we're so poor. It's, hey, these people are leeching Wi-Fi, trying to get their phones back on, and just doing like odd jobs in order to do it. They're so poor that when they're fumigating the streets, it's better for them to leave the windows open than to close them.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells you everything you need to know. It's all set up beautifully because even later in the film, we once again kind of see how poor they are when we get to like the flooding scene.
Brutal.
Because you just see them walking downhill from the house the entire time. And you're like, oh, they're in the absolute lowest point in town. It's metaphorical, but so literal at the same time. And not a single mention of it has to be made.
No. And the other thing too is so many movies try to just be allegories now when they don't know what to do with it. This movie's not an allegory. Everything that happens in this movie could really happen. And I think that's what's so amazing about what is pulled off in this movie is that there's a reason for all of it. They have the bunker because if North Korea ever attacks, we just want to be ready for it. Like they need a tutor because the guy's leaving and he's friends with him and he knows he's poor and he needs the money. So, hey, I'll let you be the tutor. Oh, great. Well, there's plenty of smart people who just don't have the means. And now she's going to be able to come in and she's going to be able to teach them art. And that's going to work. And so many times, the thing is, when you work around the incredibly wealthy, as this family is in this movie, they are so unaware half the time. Oh, the gardener's here. Great. Is it the same gardener that it always has been? It's not that it's you're not really paying as much attention to it. And you start to see that and why it would be easy to kind of take advantage of her. Where does the guy, was it Mr. Park? Does Mr. Park have a conversation with any of the people in the family other than the driver the entire movie?
The driver and his wife, or with the family that's coming into the house?
Yeah.
No?
I don't think so, right? Maybe he has one with the, but even when the mother, who's now the maid of the house, even when she is there, when he's having a conversation, it's more around her. It's more oh, did you get this? Did you get that? Blah, blah, blah. You are my servant at this point. What did you get for me? There's so much power to that. There's just so much power to the decisions that are made in this movie. And the fact that essentially this movie is two different movies. It is the movie of watching a family elevate, and it is a movie about watching a family who now is losing everything that they just got. This isn't a movie that works its way up for 2 hours and then they succeed. This is a movie about imposters coming in and completely taking over and becoming that family. And then after that, having to deal with the realities that they aren't that family. They get their one taste of the good life and go home and the toilet's exploding and there's shit everywhere. This is sewage water. Be careful, whatever. And that's what their lives is now, are now. They get the reminder very quickly that no, you're not this. You're that. You smell. You are this. You are trash. And it leads to one of the most epic finales of a movie ever with that murder and getting your head smashed in and you never expect the sister to die and the sister dies. And then, the father goes missing and you don't know where the father is. It's just brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
What Bong Joon-ho does so well in this film is he manages, like you said, he makes two movies, but they're two movies of completely different genres too, which is the wild thing, because that the first half of the movie is this black comedy about this family just kind of haha, we're tricking them, we get to live the life. And then all of a sudden it turns into this terrifying thriller in the back half of the film. And they're both executed so well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's another thing too, why I think it's so important that this movie was made not in America. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think in America they would let him get away with making a movie that is so different from one half to the other. That scene where she goes running down the stairs and then she gets through all that and you find out that, oh my God, there's another room. And it's that one big tracking shot running down. You're like, what the hell is going on? This is not what this movie was up till this point. And some of the visuals of this, her in the rain with the swollen face still from the peaches, to let me in, all that stuff. And him in the basement and how dark and dreary all that is. It's just, it's brutal. And what ends up happening, and I think this is the best thing that he does in this movie. After that, it starts turning into the poor trying to screw each other over. They get their little bit of power in this movie, and they start immediately trying to turn on each other. And instead of working together to ultimately be wow, this family's really screwed us over or whatever it is, they literally start to just be how can I make it so that you're the bad person or you're the bad person or whatever it is. And it's that whole mindset of, well, how do the rich stay rich and all that? They do their thing and they don't worry about what's going on here. And everybody else just keeps fighting amongst themselves. So they're not worried about moving their way up. And that's what this movie does so brutally when they're sitting there with the phone. This is like having your finger on a nuclear missile. This is great.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. And that, I think, is the greatest social commentary of this film, is the idea that, because we see it all the time, right? We've all seen the billboards that are why does naloxone cost, or get, why do drug addicts get Noxylane for free and I have to pay $750 for my insulin? Mm-hmm. And it's that idea that, like, you're targeting the wrong people here. It's not the people who are also poor like you. It's the people who are making you pay the $750 for the insulin that we should be looking at. And the fact that in this movie, we do get the poor going after the poor because they're just like, no, this is how the world works. We have to get above each other here because that's how we got into this place in the first time, was kind of stepping on people to get there. Mm-hmm. And we have to maintain that. And I also think that's what's so beautiful about the dad in the end, just killing Mr. Park when he does when he makes the gesture about the smell again, because at that point it's like the realization of I've been going after the wrong people this entire time.
Yeah, exactly. And who kills his daughter? You know what I mean? Like, it's the poor person who kills her, but that's not who really put them in that position. He's been nothing but great to this guy the whole movie. Mm-hmm. He talks, he drives him around, he does all that. At the end of the day, there's still such a divide. There's no real camaraderie there. And in that moment, he realizes, you know, get away, come on, hurry up and drive us away, get us to safety, all that, while there's a girl laying on the ground dying who just got stabbed by somebody who she didn't deserve to get stabbed. That lack of care for that person just totally sets him off. And it's the smell and all that. It's ultimately, it's respect. And Bong Joon-ho. His movies are so much like this. Snowpiercer is this. Yeah. It's so much about class. Snowpiercer is a lot less subtle, that's for sure.
Yes.
But still, his movies are so much about class. Because the people who are rich don't want to give it up, and the people who are poor want to be rich. Mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to. And this movie is so masterful at getting the people who are poor to become rich. They work their way all the way to the top just to have it all taken from them. And I will say, the ending of this movie wrecks me every time.
Oh, yeah.
That final speech in this movie is so well done. And the whole talk about all that, all you're going to have to do is walk upstairs. And he walks upstairs. And you're like, oh, my God, he did it. And then it says, cuts to the snow falling there. And you're like, okay, like maybe this is just like the last shot. Whatever. But until then, take care. Brutal. Just absolutely brutal.
It's that realization that, oh, this will never happen.
Never going to happen.
There's no way he could ever do this. Mm-hmm. It's just this fantasy of like hoping to have that day one day where he can – where he can save his dad, but it's impossible.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen. It's so heartbreaking. And it's just like, it leaves you completely devastated at the end of this film. That's already pretty devastating.
Yeah, no, it is absolutely brutal. It is absolutely brutal. And it gives you that hope. And how many times do you daydream about that? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, you know, I grew up middle class, but still, like, you daydream about, like, there's going to be that day where I'm, you know, you're by the house. I always think about the Kanye West song where he's just talking about how he's going to buy his mom every car and every house and all that shit. And it's just like, he got there. He went from really, really poor and growing up really, really shitty to now he buys his mom whatever the hell she wants. And I always, like, it's that whole thing of, like, Dad, I made a plan today. And it's, you daydream, I'm gonna start making a lot of money. And I'm going to buy this house and nobody's going to be able to outbid me on it. And you're just going to have to walk up the stairs and everything is going to be great. It's like you always think about it. But now when you're putting the gravity of how important it is for him to be able to do that, to save his father's life or never see his father again, this is the only chance he has.
Yeah.
It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal.
And it's even more brutal when you realize he can never get this letter to his father in the first place.
Exactly.
He's writing this letter to himself as like a commitment to this plan he can never achieve.
Like writing down your New Year's resolutions.
Exactly. It's just heartbreaking.
It is. It really, really is. And I just think that like I'm surprised that they haven't tried to make more movies like this, Hollywood at least, But I also think Hollywood's been struggling with the pandemic and all of that stuff and, you know, trying to figure out how can we actually make more movies like this and whatever, yeah. like, you know, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah. But this movie will never be replicated. And when they do try to, they're not going to remake it because it's too popular. It's too popular of a Korean film to be remade because at the end of the day, like, you know, whatever American studio picked it up for release in America made plenty of money. And they already know it's a classic that you really can't yeah. touch. But this is a movie that when they try to do something with the same themes, it's always going to be compared to this and it's always going to fail. Like, it really is just always going to fail when it's coming to those same themes. And I look back at, like, The Rules of the Game, which, you know, was the movie that I originally chose. Ends the same way. A person gets yeah. killed that doesn't deserve to get killed. They cover it up because they have the power to do it, whatever it is. And ultimately, the person who doesn't belong is the one who suffers the most. Not the people who are rich, but the person who doesn't belong. As everybody else is worried about their own little stuff, it's the people who tried to work their way into it who end up ultimately failing. And, you know, both movies are such a strong look at social structure and class and things like that. But, man, Parasite, like in 80 years, when somebody sits down and watches Parasite, which I'll be dead. But in 80 years, when somebody sits down and watches Parasite, are they going to say, like, wow, I really don't understand that scene? Maybe with the Wi-Fi. That was the only thing I was thinking. Like, maybe with Wi-Fi, by that point, everybody's sure. going to have whatever in their brain. But for the most part, I still feel like the topics that are covered in this movie are just absolutely universal. And has there ever been a movie that people have so uniformly gotten behind, whether they're cinephiles or just regular movie-going audiences, than Parasite? Like, as quickly as people have?
It's a movie that when I first went and saw Parasite in theaters, I explained what it was mm-hmm. to a friend of mine. A friend and I were going, and we were at a store that a friend of ours owns, and he was like, what are you guys going to go see? And it's like, we're going to go see Parasite. It's this Korean movie about, like, wealth disparity and everything, and it's a black comedy. And he's like, that sounds terrible.
Yeah.
But I also sat and watched it with my roommate who hadn't seen it before this week, and he was like, oh, completely enthralled in this movie. It's late. We started it later than we intended. So he usually has a habit of falling asleep when we get too late into movies. And he's like sitting there, wide-eyed, peeled to the screen. He hates reading subtitles, but he's just there. And he's so enthralled by this movie. And that just really goes to show how important it is that this movie happened. Because mm-hmm. there are people out there who refuse to watch movies because they have subtitles. But because yeah. of how universally well-received this movie was, people are now way more willing to watch foreign language films.
I agree. Yeah, it's and I mean, Squid Game, I haven't seen Squid Game, but Squid Game is also Korean, correct?
It is. And it's very similar themes.
It's subtitled?
It is.
Yeah.
They also, they released a dub of it on Netflix as well. And I think a lot of people did watch the dub. Mm-hmm. No, I watched the subtitle.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I would too. Yeah, I just think it's interesting how this movie really, especially being that it was a foreign language film, mm-hmm. to get so many people on board with that and then have it win Best Picture and have nobody complain that it won Best Picture.
Especially
that's insane.
Like, especially the year this movie came out, like, this was
good year,
really good year for film.
Yeah.
And to have the Best Picture winner come and be the first foreign language Best Picture winner mm-hmm. in, like, with all the films released in 2019 of all years, it's saying something about how important this film was and how loved it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's very, I think it's very interesting that it was able to have such success. And I think, again, it just comes down to the themes and the story. I mean, you see these movies all the time that are trying to be more than they are coming out of Hollywood, where, you know, it is so on the note and people get tired of watching that. People get tired of watching the same old shit. But this movie also has, like, an action element to it, even though it's not an action movie. It has a horror element to it, even though it's not a horror. It has a comedy element to it, even though it's not a comedy. It's got a dramatic element to it, even though it's not a genre. It's, like, a very non-genre movie yep. that fits into almost every single genre. And I just think that that just captured people. I think that just caught people off guard. And now here they are.
Yeah, exactly. And it also helps that, like, it's written very well. The progression of the plot is just the right pacing, where you're never at a point where you're like, okay, this scene's going on too long, or where's this going? You never get to that point in this film.
The only time you do, though, is when they're sitting around drinking.
And it's so intentional, because it's that turning point in the film.
Because you start to say, okay, now they've hit the high of highs. Where's this movie going to go now? They've all made it in. The family's gone. They're drinking. What more is going to happen? And it takes its time. So it just drags out. And that doorbell ringing, it's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying.
It is. And we also have absolutely phenomenal performances. Kong Ho Song is absolutely incredible as the father.
Yeah, he should have been nominated and maybe even won.
I agree. Personally, Brad Pitt was right? Yeah.
Okay.
Personally, I think Sodom Park, who plays Jessica, is far and away the best performance in this movie.
She's great. She's great. Yeah. I still think the father's the best, but she's great too. She's so good at the she has just such a good like stare. She's such a good stare. And she does play kind of like a dual character very, very well. Where she's the only one out of all of them who's more confident with the rich people than not. Everybody else holds their own. I'm not saying that, but she's somebody who totally feels comfortable in that situation.
And we get that discussion as well. Yep. We get that discussion when they're all drinking together, and it's like, you look like you belong when you were sitting in the tub.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's hammered.
She's the one who dies.
Because she's the one who would have taken their position. They needed to get rid of her.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, and I love all the stuff that goes on in the basement. The line in here that you can't catch the first time, so it's not your fault. But about, you know, she's a great housekeeper, but she eats enough for two people.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Like, it's absolutely brilliant foreshadowing that there's someone living in the basement. So she is eating for two people because there's someone down there. It's brilliant. Brilliant foreshadowing.
Yeah. No, it the film's masterly put together, and it's going to be a long time before we see another film that is so expertly crafted as Parasite is.
Yeah, and Universal. And I think, like, you know, we saw Nomadland win Best Picture last year. That was not universally loved. I didn't like it. I didn't really like it that much at all. And whatever's going to win Best Picture this year, not going to have the same feel. It's kind of looking like The Power of the Dog right now. That's not going to be a universally loved movie.
Nope.
It's just not. And that's fine. I'm not saying you have to. I just think it's so impressive what Parasite was able to pull off. And also the name of the movie. I mean, to call it Parasite. Oh,
so good.
It's so good. It's so
good.
Who's
the Parasite? Who's the Parasite in this relationship? Is it the poor family or is it the rich who are exploiting the poor family?
Who's actually being parasitic to who? And I think that's also what's great is it's a one-word title, that it's just Parasite. Because it's not telling you – and, like, that was, like, the funny thing. Like, when I heard about this movie, I was like, oh, it must be, like, a movie about – because, like, he had made The Host and all that. So I'm like, oh, it must be a movie about, like, a bug that kills people or something. And then you watch and you're like, yeah, who is the parasite? Everybody is parasitic to everybody else. You have the guy in the basement who is feeding off of them. You have the poor people who are feeding off of the rich people to become rich, but then you have the rich people feeding off the poor people to live their lives. It's just, and nobody is actually being beneficial to the other that they're using.
No.
It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. Or I guess they all, in their ways, are being beneficial, but not beneficial in the way that the other people want them to be beneficial. It's just, it's a brilliant, brilliant title for a movie that perfectly captures all of it. Just all of it.
Yeah. And I love how we even get, like, that turning point where, again, the turning point happens with like, the stone. The metaphorical stone that's so important in this film, where they get it, and then all of a sudden things start going really well for them, and it's only when the son disrupts it, and he goes to take it to, again, more foreshadowing leading to that stone being thrown at someone's head.
Yeah.
And that's the point when everything starts crumbling. It's just so beautiful. That they just couldn't leave a beat, and that's what happened. Is They couldn't leave it be, and everything went to shit.
Yeah. No, it's a great movie, and it's one that, like, unfortunately, we don't need to talk as much about because it's still very much in the conversation, and I'm just glad to see that it is so universally acclaimed because it deserves it. And, you know, a lot of people thought Minari would end up winning Best Picture the next year. Like, that was how quickly all that just...
To be fair, that movie was also incredibly good.
Oh, it was a great movie. Great movie, and I really thought it was going to win Best Picture, but then we actually do get an acting win for that movie, so there you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, Parasite is a phenomenal movie, and it's not one that we really have to tell people to go watch because everybody's seen it. But it's amazing.
You know what? Even if you have, just watch it again.
Just watch it again. It gets better every single time. This is the fourth time I watched it, and it was better than the third time I watched it, which is better than the second time I watched it, better than the first. It's just an amazing movie. It really is. It hits on all levels. It is so – the theme, the tone, the setting, everything is perfect. The characters are great. The rain – all of that, the lights coming on now that you can look for those things. It's just pure brilliance. It's just pure brilliance. So that's it. That's it. Parasite and the Last Days of Disco. Next week, we're moving on to round three of me not being allowed to talk about my top 100 movie. I'm supposed to have The Social Network, but John just keeps putting all my movies up high. So we're going to be talking about Drive for me. I'm footing that it is the replacement, Drive. John has Hero from 2002. So Drive from 2011, Hero from 2002. Those are our two movies from next week. It's looking like we're going to be doing it on Monday night after the Danny podcast for anybody who listens to our Survivor stuff. And then we finally get into a stretch. I only have two more movies that we have to replace, which will be very nice. I had a friggin' long stretch here. It's you who has to start replacing coming up.
It is.
But yeah. Yeah, so that'll be good. Three in a row where I didn't actually talk about a movie in my top 100, although Last Days of Disco is definitely going to end up there, so what am I talking about? But anyway.
Also, Parasite's in your top 100. You got to talk about it this week.
That's true, but I wanted to talk about what I wanted to talk about, not when you wanted to talk about it. It would have been a better conversation last week, that's all. But yeah, anyway, that's it. Appreciate everybody listening. Thank you all. We'll be back next week. Two more episodes, and then we've done 50. That's crazy. Two more till 50, halfway through. That's wild. See everybody next Monday.